from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, 2017 was a historic year for the nation's transgender community. Six transgender people won elections nationwide, including here in California, when Lisa Middleton won her seat on Palm Springs City Council and became the state's first openly trans person elected to a non-judicial post. The foundation for these and other successes, and where we go from here, are what Susan Stryker looks at in her book, Transgender History, The Roots of Today's Revolution. She joins us on Forum after this news. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Transgender activists and their allies have made big gains in the past 10 years when it comes to social and legal recognition, medical advances, and media representation. And those changes prompted Susan Stryker to update her seminal work, Transgender History, which was first published in 2008, profiling people who dared to challenge social expectations of gender as far back as the 1600s. Her revised edition is called Transgender History, The Roots of Today's Revolution. But Stryker is acutely aware that so-called bathroom bills and attempts to bar trans people from serving in the military threaten to undo recent gains. And in her book, she also offers a vision for the future. Welcome to Forum, Susan Stryker.
Thank you.
So was there a moment in 2017 that really stands out to you when you said to yourself, wow, I didn't think we'd get here?
I think all of 2017 has stood out as I didn't really think that we would get here. I mean, it's kind of I think it's kind of a nightmare that we're living inside of right now. And yet I remain hopeful. I mean, it's like I'm actually working on another book right now besides the one that we're talking about today, which is called What Transpires Now, Transgender History and the Future We Need, which is precisely about the relationship between sort of the current crisis and why it's important to understand history as a way of having some means of envisioning a different future.
And talk about what you mean by the current crisis more specifically.
Well, you know, I have to say when I started working on this other book, it's like the assumption was Hillary Clinton was going to be president. And I thought the biggest challenge for talking about trans politics would be to say, you know, not so fast, liberal America, just because some trans people have, you know, more rights and better access to health care, the struggle isn't over. It's like we have to deal with, you know, the really uneven distribution of rights and privileges and benefits for trans people. It's like trans people of color are still like in a really, you know, usually like pretty bad situation. You know, it's like, let's not over celebrate, you know, recent advances. And that's just not the story that needs to be told anymore. It's like, I think we're experiencing right now a major pushback against the advances that trans people have won over the past couple of decades. And, you know, it makes me think of, you know, like Reconstruction after the Civil War. It's like we fought a civil war. You know, African American citizens had rights for a while. There's this Reconstruction period, and then there's this really pronounced rollback where it's like it's worse in the 1880s than it was in the 1870s. And I think that's kind of happened with trans people. It's like we have made some advances over the last couple of decades, and right now we are experiencing the stripping away of rights that have been won. It's like, and that is pretty historically unusual.
And yet your book does strike the hopeful note that it'll be very difficult to roll back in a significant way the gains that have been made. So let's focus on what those gains are, maybe before we go into a little more detail about the concerns and how things can get stripped away. Why do you think it will be hard to undo them?
So I do think we're in this reactionary moment where a lot of state legislatures are passing these bathroom bills, or where, you know, as you mentioned, trans people had won the right to be in the military, and now that's under assault, in question. We have been able to secure healthcare treatment for transgender specific needs. You know, healthcare itself is, you know, under assault right now. So there are some very specific things that have been pushed back.
Yes.
But I just think the cultural climate is really different. People understand gender differently now than they did a generation ago. It's like if you poll young people. It's like the number of people who are identifying as gender nonconforming, or the number of people who go to school with a, you know, a trans kid. The level of cultural consciousness about this has really dramatically shifted. There's been like climate change around gender, you know.
And which is much harder to crumble
away. I think
or
that
away.
Those changes in awareness and perception, and that change in the understanding of gender and gender identity, I don't think that genie goes back in the bottle at all. And so how that plays out in the future remains to be seen. But I think it'll be kind of like the gay marriage debate. You know, 20 years ago, it was not a winning proposition. And in a generation, it's totally flipped. And I think that that's happening with transgender issues as well.
It's interesting you bring up the terms, because your book focuses, its first chapter is all about how the lingo around transgender has shifted in past decades. You say transgender came into widespread use in the last couple of decades, and the meaning is still under construction. So first, could you tell me how you define transgender for this book titled Transgender History, right? How did you determine who into this category?
Well, there's a way that I take a very broad interpretation of that term. It's like what I say in the book is that I think of transgender, it means it's like we are all assigned a starting place in life. You know, we come into a world that exists before us, and somebody says you're a boy or a girl, you're put in a particular place that's unchosen. And that as you develop your sense of who you are, if you're somebody who crosses socially imposed borders between genders from this unchosen starting place, then I'll call that trans. Like trans just sort of means moving across. So if you're moving across, you know, a socially defined gender boundary from this unchosen starting place, I'm just going to call that trans, which is broad. It's like so that there could be a way that, you know, many people might think of themselves as being trans. Like even if you think you're, say, like a feminist woman who like doesn't want to be a, you know, June Cleaver housewife, it's like, well, you're transgressing a social boundary of gender. So you're transgressing or transing that gender boundary. So the goal for me is like to not think of transgender people as some kind of like unique, obscure, weird, little, tiny minority of exotic gender people, but to think that we're all, you know, caught up in a social gendering system, and that we, you know, we all make our way through it. There's like, you know, resistance or identification, you know, that can happen in many different ways, many different combinations for everybody.
There was a recent survey, transgender survey, that showed that a third of respondents were identifying as non-binary. Can you explain non-binary?
Well, binary, two, you know, pink and blue, man, woman, boy, girl, and that there are increasing numbers of people, sort of what I was alluding to earlier, who just go like, yeah, that's sort of not how I think about myself. And so that they think of themselves either as some combination or as some third thing or as someone who goes back and forth between these binary positions. And so it's like we have a cultural belief that our gender identities are sort of rooted in the biology of our bodies, you know, but that's just a belief. It's like, you know, your body is one thing and how you think about yourself is something else. And increasingly, you know, people are going like, yeah, just because my body is like this doesn't mean I have to be this kind of person or that kind of person. I have the capacity to transform myself, to live differently. You know, society should, you know, accept me that I do things a little differently. It's not bad. It's just different. People, you know, should have the – if you feel very strongly that you are a certain kind of person and – you want to live that way and identify that way, I mean, why not? Where's the harm? So, yeah, this sense of being able to detach ourselves from our culture's historical understanding of what the meaning of our body has been. It's like that's changing. That's the climate change around gender.
And you noted in your book that young people are in some ways driving this different sense of permission to express their gender in this way, in a non-binary kind of way.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I'm 56 years old. You know, I'm starting to feel like, you know, I'm, you know, granny transgender person. And, you know, there's a way that I understand myself. I understand the historical experiences that I have is now like increasingly like a historical relic, you know. So if I want to like keep current, you know, you got to look at what, you know, kids today are doing. And like, you know, people who are 20 and 30 years younger than me understand gender really differently than I do. So like this is where I get to feel like I'm the, you know, the academic researcher who's just looking at society. It's like, isn't it interesting the way that, you know, people are understanding genders? Like, this is really significant that our cultural understanding of gender is changing and people are developing gender identities in ways that are as alien to me in some ways as they are to people who've never thought about it before.
Yes, though I do remember reading Judith Butler's book, Gender Trouble in College, and just having it blow my mind because she was characterizing gender as a performance, as a construct, right, independent of biology. And that was sort of the first time that I'd heard it, and that was in the mid-90s. And then speaking of non-binary, I'm reminded that there was new legislation passed, a new law that that starts in 2019 where Californians can identify themselves as not just male or female, but non-binary. So that term really does seem to be taking off. And when you talk about being 56 years old, which is young, but yet you're very much part of the history of transgender, of the transgender community and transgender activism, and your book focuses a lot on that. I mean, it goes back to the 1600s, and it talks about folks and the shoulders that trans people stand on today, but it really focused a lot more post-World War II. Why that time period?
You know, it's post-World War II. I think that social movements started around trans identity. It's like there have been people who, like, if we look at them through the lens of, you know, concepts today, you go like, that looks transgendered to me, you know. And, you know, there's always been people like that. But it really wasn't until after World War II that you start to see, you know, just like you saw a Black Power movement or you saw a Brown Power movement or an American Indian movement. It's like a minority identity movement for social change. You know, the feminist movement, the gay liberation movement, they're all like really, even though they have deep roots, they're largely post-World War II developments. And part of what I'm trying to do in my book is to say, you know, there was a transgender social change movement as well. And that, you know, it starts with these people. And so there's a difference between saying people like us have existed in the past versus saying people that we recognize as our kin somehow have been engaged in social change movements. So I've focused on the social change movement stuff.
We're talking with Susan Stryker, Associate Professor of Gender and Women's Studies at the University of Arizona, and the author of Transgender History, which she's updated since it was first published in 2008, because of strides that transgender activists have made in the last few decades. One of the moments of activism that you won an Emmy for, which is for the documentary film Screaming Queens, The Riot at Compton's Cafeteria. Compton's Cafeteria is here in San Francisco in the Tenderloin. And it's the first known major episode of transgender resistance to social oppression?
Well, you know, first is always a fraught concept, but
especially for historians, I'm sure.
Especially for historians. What I can say, I mean, that many people know about Stonewall, you know, the revolution, you know, the riots in New York in the late 1960s, 1969, where, you know, gay and trans people resisted at a police raid at a bar in Greenwich Village, and this is supposedly where gay liberation starts. And Stonewall was a really important event, no question about it. But, you know, there was this thing here in San Francisco in 1966 where at the corner of Turk and Taylor Streets and the Tenderloin, there was an all-night cafeteria that was frequented by people who, you know, worked on the streets and lived in the neighborhood. And the police would come in and raid there as well. And 3 years before Stonewall, trans women and, you know, gay hustlers and street youth did fight back against the police in a very Stonewall-like event. You know, there were other moments before then at you know, Dewey's lunch counter in Philadelphia in 1964, or Cooper Donuts in Los Angeles in 1959. But what makes Compton's special to me, I think, is that it was the moment where it wasn't just sort of a spontaneous mass resistance to the structural violence of police repression of trans people, but that when people stood up at Compton's, the city changed a little bit. It's like policing practices change. It's like clinics open. It's like it was the moment that provoked the city of San Francisco to deal with its transgender population differently. So it wasn't just, you know, the expression of anger. It was like the expression of anger and resistance that changed social structures. And that, I think, was the first time at Compton's, was the first time that trans people had succeeded in changing something of the broader social fabric that they lived in, rather than just surviving it.
Yes, and then sort of the ripple effect of cultural changes. The other thing you focus on in the book is the changing of media representation of trans people. And I'm wondering if you could describe, I mean, we have today people like Caitlyn Jenner, Laverne Cox, Janet Mock, and others who we have shows like Transparent. We also just have different ways that trans people are being discussed in the media. And I was wondering if you could remind us, maybe we don't even need that much reminding, but how the mass media representation was before, how it tended to be around trans people, and how you feel like it's evolved.
Well, first, there was very little representation of sort of female to male or trans masculine people at all. It was almost all trans women or, you know, male to female people, or male to female cross-dressing. And when you would see that, it would either be, you know, a moment of hilarity. You know, it's Milton Berle in a dress, or it's Flip Wilson, or it's like, it's, you know, sticky cross-dresser, you know, Medea, you know, kind of, you know, broad supposed humor. Or we were represented as being psychotic, you know, it's the dress to kill, deranged, cross-dressed serial killer. Or it was something that you would be revolted by, you know, like sort of, you know, Jim Carrey and Ace Ventura, you know, just like that there's a scene where it's like somebody is revealed to be trans and we have, you know, vomit jokes, you know, that come after that. So that was pretty much the state of affairs. It was very, very rare that you would see any kind of positive representation of trans people. And that is what has really changed. It's like, I think there's still a lot of focus on transition stories, you know, like in gay and lesbian culture, it's like there's was for a long time a focus on just the coming out story. Like that was the only thing interesting about gay people. It's like, oh, they come out, you know. That's it. What else do they do? It's like, I don't know. And so with trans people, it's like, what do trans people do? It's like, they change sex. You know, it's like, what else do they do? It's like, I don't know. We don't care about anything else. So now you're starting to see stories of trans people that are more positive and aren't just about transition. You know, it's like it's trans people who are just, you know, doing whatever it is that they're doing. There's something interesting or not interesting about their character that has nothing to do with their being trans. It's just, you know, some people are that way and some people aren't. And we're just seeing more and more of that. I think Transparent has actually done an amazing job, the TV show Transparent on Amazon, that it has a lot of trans people connected with it, you know, writers, people who are producers, people who direct, people who act. There's like trans people shot throughout the production of that show. And, you know, I do think it was a sort of a quantum shift in how representation happened. The other show that I think has made a lot of impact is Sense8, which is on Netflix. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there is a trans character on that show. But what I think is more interesting is that you have trans people, you know, the Wachowski sisters, Lana and Lily, who have been they have a lot of aesthetic control over that show. And so it's like you're seeing a show from a trans perspective that's not necessarily strictly about being trans. So there's a kind of transgender aesthetic in that whole production, I think. So, you know, it's just completely mind-blowing to me that this is happening right now. So, and it's part of that sea change, that climate shift that I was talking about, that there's just so many more points of reference for trans in our culture And I don't think that's what's going to get put back inside the box.
Well, let me put that out to our listeners. We'd like to hear your experiences. If you're trans in the Bay Area, has life changed for you in the last decade? How have you experienced some of these changes that Susan Stryker is talking about? Susan Stryker, of course, is Associate Professor of Gender and Women's Studies at the University of Arizona, though a Bay Area resident as well. And her second edition of her classic text, Transgender History, has a new introduction and updated material, and we're talking about some of the things that she's added. Also, how do you think the increased visibility of trans people in politics, the media, like Laverne Cox or Janet Mock or even Chelsea Manning, are changing the conversation in America? Do you worry about the backlash that Susan Stryker mentioned at the top of the hour? 866-733-6786 is the number to call. You can post your comments on our website, kqed.org/forum. On Twitter, we're at kqedforum. On Facebook, or you can email us at forum@kqed.org. And that number one more time, 866-733-6786. There's one other thing I want to talk to you about before we go into the break, which was some of the changes that you noted in medicine, and in particular the 2013 DSM, no longer considering essentially being transgender a disorder.
That's correct. for most of 20th century trans history, it's like the way that we've gotten what we've needed for ourselves in terms of ability to sort of change our bodies has been on the result of being diagnosed with, you know, a medical condition. And there's been a lot of controversy about that in trans communities because most people just think it's like, you know, I didn't ask to be this way, but I am. It's like it's a perfectly fine way to be, but I need some kind of medical services around it. Like if a woman wants to get pregnant and have a baby, it's like, well, maybe she needs some medical attention around that, but it's not an illness to like want to be pregnant or to need a doctor for that. And then also there's been a lot of politics around, insurance. It's like trans medical needs were not seen as, you know, legitimate insurable conditions, is that not covered by healthcare plans. There's a lot of resentment over, like, do you have to be diagnosed with a mental illness to just sort of be who you are? You know, it's like, so, and yet this is the mechanism for saying, like, all right, it's like, I feel like I need to take hormones or I need to have differently shaped body parts or, you know, just like, so there was that nexus about, you know, the medical nexus that we had to sort of insert ourselves into was very much there, very pathological, pathologizing. And I think it's remarkable that in the last revision of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of the American Psychiatric Association, there's been this significant shift to say, feeling unhappy about your gender is something you might want psychological counseling or support about. There might be some medical treatments that would make you happier, but being transgender itself is not an illness. It's not a pathological way of being. The unhappiness, the dysphoria of gender is the thing that medical professionals can help you with.
We're talking with Susan Stryker, author of Transgender History, The Roots of Today's Revolution. More after the break. I'm Mina Kim. This is Forum. Stay with us. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim, and we're talking with Susan Stryker about her book, Transgender History, The Roots of Today's Revolution, that looks at transgender activism, focusing mostly on the years after World War II, and how it laid the foundation for the gains the transgender community has made today. It also touches on concerns about attempts to roll back some of those gains. And we've invited you, our listeners, to join the conversation by calling 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, by emailing us at forum@kqed.org or posting your comments on Facebook, Twitter, or on our website, kqed.org/forum. And let's go to you right now. We'll start with AJ in San Ramon. Hi, AJ.
Good morning. I'm a straight male, and I'm curious, the things that we ascribe as male and female are absolutely social constructions. I agree with your guest on that one. I was in Southeast Asia, and the color pink, for example, is not feminine. It's actually quite masculine. So if that's the case, if male and female are really social constructions, it's not about biology, why do people go and do surgical sex changes. I find it very difficult to believe that somebody would just hop out of bed and think to themselves that, gosh, I wish I had male genitals instead of female genitals. Is it that they're confusing biology with social constructions and then they mistakenly go and do a surgery?
AJ, thanks for the question. Susan Stryker.
And thank you, AJ, for that question. So what I would say is that there is a difference between biological sex difference and how we think of gender as like our social role. But I can just say for me, like why I wanted surgery and hormones was not because I hopped out of bed one day, and suddenly decided that it's what I wanted. It's like it's something that I felt my whole life about what kind of person I was and how I wanted to be in the world. And it's about like, what do I want to look like to other people when people look at me? Like, what do they see? It's like your body looks different. Or it's like, how do I want my body to fit together with another body? It's like, where do I find my pleasure, my desire? It's like, it is about how I want my body to be for myself and with others. So there's not a confusion about biology and social role, but there is like a sense of agency and choice that I was able to find. It's like, oh, my body could support my identity in a different way rather than sort of contradicting my identity. And I decided to do that. I decided to do that, to live in my own skin in the way that felt best to me. But thank you so much for your question.
How did living before as a white male influence your activism?
Well, as I mentioned in the book, it's like I want to acknowledge the privileges that I've had in life. And it's like because I have walked around in the world knowing what it feels like to get treated like a well-educated, white, native English-speaking person living in North America, it's like I have a pretty clear measuring stick of how misogyny works, how you get treated differently. It's like I know how far you can fall. I can measure that distance. And what that inspires in me is like not feeling like, oh, I just want to have these privileges that I used to have that are denied to me. It's like that kind of privileging of one kind of body over another is wrong, And it's like I feel like my being trans is where I have skin in the game about wanting to work for a more just and egalitarian society that doesn't, rank bodies by race and sex, I want to use the privileges that I've had to work for the struggles that I think are important.
And let's go to more calls. Lisa in Oakland. Hi, Lisa.
Yeah, thank you, Susan. I really appreciate your work. I wanted to follow up on what your previous caller mentioned, which is this confusion between gender and sex that seems to be still manifesting itself in what he was talking about, which is this desire to have a body that theoretically matches one's identity. And I noticed this has also come out and within the conflicts between the trans community and some radical feminists, where some radical feminists, for instance, who maybe had the Michigan Women's Music Festival and wanted a festival that celebrated female-born women, even though it didn't exclude trans people, was boycotted by the trans community, and it created a lot of horizontal hostility and a lot of attacking. And there's some feeling among radical feminists feminists generally, that now even saying you have a woman-born body is considered transphobic. And it ends up creating a very difficult situation where some people feel like they can't have a space that acknowledges their specific experience and ends up creating a lot of hostility in this between our queer brothers and sisters, which is very unfortunate to me. So I'm wondering if you could speak to some of those issues.
Lisa, thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Lisa. I agree with you that there is a lot of horizontal hostility, and I think it's because, within sort of a broader queer and trans and allied community. And, I think everybody feels like there's something about themselves that's really at stake and raw and vulnerable on the line, you know, that's on the line, you know, that people feel that their sense of themselves can somehow be erased or challenged or threatened. You know, I also like to go back to a comment earlier in the program today. It's like there are some things today for for people who are a little younger than me, who've kind of like grown up in sort of internet social media culture, who have a different sense of like what feels safe or how to call people out or how to, you know, resolve conflicts. It's like I'm not totally clued into myself. There's a lot that's up right now where people are very easily triggered. Things are inflamed. You know, there's a lot of problems that need to be resolved. And I think we're all still kind of like working our way through that. I just sort of want to acknowledge the tensions and the potentials for, you know, things to flare up. But, you know, I also do, you know, I think I disagree with you the sources of conflict at, say, the Michigan Women's Music Festival, which is like a 40-year-long festival that was, you know, for women's music that for about 25 years has been controversial in some quarters because of policies around whether trans people can participate. There was a notorious famous incident in, like, I think it was 1991 or 92, where a trans woman was expelled from the festival. And I think for, 27 years now, people have been fighting about whether or not trans people are deliberately by policy excluded from Michigan. And, you know, most trans people feel that it is not a trans welcoming space. You know, I can say that. And at the same time, you know, I can hear that people who are not trans are, you know, feeling like it's the trans people who are the problem. So it's like we're not going to be able to get into a deep discussion on the radio because we have limited time. But I would just say I think this is a really intractable problem, you know, that, you know, should be aired a lot more, and that we should all, you know, figure out ways to talk to each other differently because we're talking past each other. There's a real conflict there that would be wonderful if it could be resolved.
Well, Rick writes, I think pushback against the transgender movement might be coming from a neutral examination of trans issues. Why should a person put his or her sex reassignment costs upon the insurance industry? I feel the same way about smokers and the grossly obese. Why should schools be required to put ideas like this into the educational curricula of minors?
Well, first of all, I would say trans people exist. So, like, we're part of society. We're part of history. And just the same way you might want to talk about Chinese immigration to California, you might want to talk about the fact that trans people have been here since the gold rush, at the very least. It's just part of the social fabric. It's part of the existing diversity that actually is. So I think to include something that's there rather than to not represent it and pretend that it isn't there is, like, the better way to go. You know, and then there's, you know, the question about the provision of social services to people. It's like not everybody in society needs the same thing. It's like, why should we pay for pap smears if not everybody needs a pap smear? Why should we pay for Viagra if not everybody needs Viagra? Not everybody needs, you know, genital surgery, but some people do, and that's a legitimate expense.
There was a Pew survey that found 4 in 10 Americans saying that society has not gone far enough in accepting transgender people. But in the same survey, nearly a third said that society has gone too far. You mentioned at the top concerns about a substantial backlash, potentially. Do you feel that way? Do you feel like we'll have even more than we've seen so far? We mentioned a couple of things, but...
Well, I just think we're in such an unstable moment politically. It's like, I mean, we don't know if we're going to have a nuclear war with North Korea, you know? It's like, I mean, let's just be honest about that. It's like, you know, we don't know what's happening in the White House. It's like, we don't know how long the current president is going to be there. We don't know what the Republican Party is going to do. We don't know if there's going to be, you know, a successful opposition movement to this. Like, we just don't know right now what is happening politically. There is no script. So what's going to happen to trans? And this is like, I don't know, but it is one of the flashpoints. You know, it's one of the points that say, people who are supporters of the president can say, like, yeah, like those trans people, it's like wanting to get into our bathrooms. You know, it's like it's a thing. It's like, you know. So I don't know. It's like basically that's my answer. It's like I don't know what's going to happen on trans people. I feel a lot of risk, a lot of precariousness right now because it is something that's being targeted and scapegoated. It's become, you know, the poster child for certain things that are either wrong with or right with our society. And it feels uncomfortable to sort of be in the crosshairs of that kind of political, cultural concern with who is a member of the body politic and what should we do as a society to be a litmus test for these broader social questions. It's an uncomfortable position to be in.
And there's a chapter in your book called Tipping Point, but with a question mark. And you define it as a teeter-totter, meaning,
yeah,
it's not so much like there's going to be this point where everything kind of starts to move towards progress, but rather this question of do we take, you know, two steps forward, one step back?
Yeah, and I think that, you know, there was the famous Time magazine cover with Laverne Cox in 2014 that said, you know, is America at a transgender tipping point? And I think the moment that was being represented was like, oh, are we now sort of like rolling downhill towards, you know, full social inclusion for trans people, you know, trans people, the newest minority to arrive at the table of social inclusion, welcome. And I think that was wrong. That did not, in fact, happen. And so, you know, I sort of wanted to play with that idea of like, well, we did tip towards something, but things, the momentum has shifted in another direction right now. We tipped back. So that idea of trans as a fulcrum, you know, that these social questions are hinging on. But the pushback, I mean, things like there was a case involving a trans teenager who, you know, was trying to use the toilets in his public school. And, you know, it became, you know, it was headed towards the Supreme Court. And I think that that ruling, if it had gone to the Supreme Court and won, it's like that would secure rights for trans people more broadly, you know, the way that Roe v. Wade did for abortion, or, you know, Obergefell versus Hodges did for same-sex marriage, that we were on the cusp of a really significant legal victory for trans rights. And because of all the, you know, political, you know, the backlash that's happened because of the shift, the unexpected shift that took place after the November election in 2016, it's like the Supreme Court sent that case back down and is not hearing it. And I really do think that the legal environment for trans people, like we lost a generation. You know, it's like it's not, there are some things that are not legal rights that are not going to be secured for a generation at this point. We missed the window.
And let's go to more calls. Lee in Oakland. Hi, Lee.
Hi. I just want to say hi to Susan. We met, I think, in 1999 at a San Francisco State Conference when I was a baby tranny activist. So,
hey.
Hi. I so appreciate your work as an academic and historian. I'm, you know, 20-odd years later, straight, married. I'm a parent. I'm an attorney. And what I struggle with is, you know, kind of the inverse of your experience. I have all this privilege, and it's amazing how much of it is just, you know, given to me when I'm not even trying to seek it. And, you know, I'm at this next phase of my life where I have to decide whether I'm going to come out to other parents of my kid, what am I going to say to my kid when she's old enough. And those stories are not being told. And so I'm really interested in hearing about that next wave of representation of trans folks who are deep into their transition at this point and living their lives, but still holding all of these identities.
Yeah, well, maybe that's the book you should write.
I'm working on it.
Okay, right on. So, I mean, it's just like, I'll just bouncing off what you were saying, it's like, I feel like part of what you're saying is like being trans in today's world. It's like we are here. We are like woven throughout the social fabric. As a historian, I can say gender variant, gender different people have always been part of the social fabric, and that's really been invisibilized. our stories are multitudinous. It's not just about transitioning. It's not just, you know, doctor, ever since I was a little kid, I felt I was an X and I want to be a Y. And they say, I can help you with that. And then that's the end of the story. You know, like thinking about how trans people have families, how we work, how we, you know, experience inequality and injustice, ways that our transness is related to other aspects of our life, whether we're like a white person, a person of color, whether we're like rich, whether we're poor, you know, how does transness thread itself through all of that social difference, and what difference does it make, you know, to be trans? And so, you know, I just think it's a sort of an exploding, proliferating area of cultural inquiry. And there are so many stories to be told. And, you know, so I just encourage you to tell yours.
Well, thank you, Lee, for the question. Let me go next to Rachel in San Francisco. Hi, Rachel.
Hi. Yeah. I'd like to, Susan, thank you so much. I've been following you for a number of years. I'm 67 years old, and I live here in San Francisco, and I'm an architect. And what I wanted to say was that what for me the real, you know, you talked about the tipping point, and for me, I really thought when Bruce became Caitlin and came out. For my generation, and I'm older than you are, everybody knew Bruce Jenner. You know, he was like the most famous, you know, athlete in the world, you know, when he won that, you know, the decathlon. So for so many people, it just made, who had no clue what we were, they suddenly had some bucket to put it in. And I saw that. And so when I looked at it and I said, well, what can I do? So what, to further our, you know, our cause, so to speak, is to just be out in the world freely and openly as a trans woman, and I'm a professional, and I work in some of the most conservative places. In fact, I live in a world where I'm the only trans person I run into very much. You know what I mean? It's like, I like it, you know? So it's like, I think that's where we can just be okay with it and let people see us and say, look, yeah, I'm here, you know, deal with it.
Rachel, thanks for that.
Yeah, thank you for that. It's like, and, you know, good luck with your outness. You know, that I do think it's important. And I also think it's important to, you know, to recognize that not everybody has the opportunity to be out. Sometimes that like can be, some people don't pass as non-trans, and some people don't have the safety to be perceived as trans. And so it's just a really personal, individual choice, I think, that people have to face about their level of outness. Yeah, but it's like for people who can be out and tell their stories, that's an important form of social change right there.
Well, here's a little story from Lindsay. I identify as a queer woman. I recently changed from sometimes feeling like a man and sometimes feeling like a woman to realizing that masculine and feminine traits are not really actually attached to gender. There isn't a spectrum at all to slide along anymore. If I'm feeling outgoing and strong while I work on my car, it doesn't mean I'm being masculine. It means I'm being me. Let's go next to Justin in San Francisco. Hi, Justin.
Hello there. Susan, I'm a huge, longtime fan.
Thanks.
And, I wanted to ask about, you were mentioning before when you were talking about the Wachowski sisters, trans cultural and artistic production, kind of trans aesthetics that are emerging. I was wondering if you could talk more about that, put it maybe in some historical context and what you see as a kind of trans artistic voice or aesthetic.
Justin, thanks.
That is a great question. To just talk for just a second about Sense8, it's like one of the things I like in that show, which is, you know, for those who don't watch it, it's a science fiction show where there's a cluster of people who all sort of share the same sensory apparatus, and that they're connected psychically to each other, even though they have different bodies in different parts of the world, but they can kind of experience what the other people in their cluster are experiencing. And that sense of who you know yourself to be not being connected to your body, you know, and to the, you know, specific things about your body, your, you know, skin color or genital shape or geographical, you know, place of upbringing, you know, your history, that sense of subjectivity being something that's not quite the same thing always as your body, that capacity to imagine differently and to connect to people differently than what you think is possible. It's like, to me, like there's something very trans about that. So, I mean, that's just like just one little example. And, you know, I think another example has to do with questions about representation. So like in the show Transparent, it's like I think that show is mostly about a sometimes tragically, sometimes comically dysfunctional upper middle class Jewish family in Los Angeles, and that it happens to have a person in it who's trans, but that it's mostly not actually about being trans. It's mostly about being Jewish. And so it's just like I love the sort of shift that was possible in that show to just contextualize trans people in a different way. And it came from people who have trans experience being involved in the show and being able to represent things that just were not represented before. I don't know if you saw the last season, season four, but like there were these scenes where you're seeing the Maura character and the Shelley character both as adults and as young people who were getting together. And the way that the show would cut back and forth between different actors of different sexes representing the same characters, or the ways that like voice from one historical period, you know, like when Maura is Mort as a young person, you're seeing, or you're hearing that voice go with the adult Maura. You know, just there's all kinds of stuff about playing with gender and time that to me felt very much like that was a trans experience being represented.
Well, Justin, thanks for the question. And Rebecca, we have about 5 minutes left. She's taking on a different question, which she asks, this is a broad question. At what age do you think it's appropriate for a young person to start hormone treatment?
I am not a medical doctor and I do not give medical advice. But what I will say is that, you know, I think there are many different ways of being trans. It's not one thing. You know, it's like, you know, it's like if you have, you know, tuberculosis, it's like you know that that came from a tuberculosis bacteria. It's like being trans is not like there's a single cause for it. It's like gender is complicated. There's opportunities for gender difference, a lot of different ways of being trans. So it's really hard to make any kind of blanket statement. What I can say is that I knew myself as a very young child that I felt gender different. You know, it was like I saw the world treat me as a boy, and I always had that question, why do I not feel like that? Why do I think I'm supposed to be over there? I can be agnostic about where that comes from, why that is, but I will just, you know, swear, you know, on anything that I find holy that that was actually the way that it was for me. Where does that come from? I don't know. So I think kids can know at a really early age that they are trans. I was one of those people. At what point do you want to say, okay, like do things that permanently change your body? It's a tough call.
Yeah. Well, Greg has a question along those lines a little bit. Hi, Greg in Redwood City.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to find out, you know, with the youth.
Oh, I think we lost you, but I
okay. Well, let me
it was
just
related
jump in
to yeah,
about,
kids
about
and
youth,
kids
is that,
being aware.
You know, I really think it should be a question about parents listening to their kids. You know, everybody's different, and that I think parents should, on the one hand, totally support how kids want to express themselves, whatever that is, and on the other hand, they should not rush to try to solve a problem, you know, that, I actually think it's like, it's okay. And at some level, it's like, you know, my experience was like, I lived for the first, you know, 20, 30 years of my life feeling this kind of gender dissonance. And I actually value the political perspective it gave me to feel that sense of unsettledness. I don't know who I would be if I had transitioned as a small child. All I would say is that parents shouldn't rush to, you know, try to, you know, say like, you know, oh my God, I thought he was my son, but she's my daughter, and now we're going to fix this problem and make it all be okay. You shouldn't parent should not feel that trans anxiousness. And on the other hand, listen to your kids and do what you know to be best because you love your children and you're listening to them and you're trying to help them come into the world to be the best person that they can be.
Well, let me see if I can squeeze in Laura's question in the minute or so we have left. She says, who or where are the famous trans men? It seems like I only hear about trans women.
Read my book. I would say one of the most, in my opinion, most famous, you know, historically important trans men was this guy, Reed Erickson, who actually came from a very wealthy industrialist family, but like he had like was the first assigned female at birth person to like get a master's degree in engineering from Louisiana State University, was in petroleum engineering. His family got crazy rich in, through petroleum industries. And when Reed inherited his family fortune, when his father died suddenly, he was the philanthropist who like funded like all of the, you know, like the sex change clinics that got set up in the 1960s. He really helped bankroll the idea of medical services for trans people, civil rights for, you know, activism for trans people. He was a really important mover and shaker.
Well, this listener, Gary, wants to thank you. He writes, I think Susan Stryker has an excellent ability to describe the transgender concept in tangible ways. I'm an older straight male with virtually no history of contact with trans people, but I'm trying to grasp the reality that Professor Stryker describes. Her clear descriptions help me better understand this societal issue. Susan Stryker, the book is Transgender History, The Roots of Today's Revolution. Thank you so much for coming in this
morning. Thanks for having me. It's been fun.
And thanks to our listeners for your questions, comments, and for listening. I'm Mina Kim. This is Forum. Have a great weekend.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.